China is one of the wealthiest and powerful nations in the world, so it might surprise you to learn that over the years, China has celebrated a National Humiliation Day, where its citizens reflect on the century of poverty, defeat, and perceived victimization by foreign imperialists that preceded its current prosperity. In their new book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, Orville Schell and John Delurie examine the fluctuations of modern Chinese history through the lives of some of its most influential leaders, activists, and thinkers. The book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased to welcome Orville Schell and John Delurie to our show today. Hello.
Greetings.
Now, over the years, I have discussed the fall and rise of China over the past century and a half with a number of historians, including you, Orville. But none has taken an approach similar to the one you've taken in this book. What got you thinking about it in this way? John?
To great measure, what started this process is rethinking how Chinese history has a new ending. When Orville started in the field of Chinese studies, and even when I started in the field of Chinese studies, I mean, Orville picked up in the 60s and 70s, and for me it was not until the 1990s. But for both of us, the question was, why did China fail? Why was it still backward? And this is the question people in China were asking and outside of China.
Because it had had such a glorious history.
Glorious history until the 19th century, and then terrible decline since then. But now we have a different ending. Now we have an ending of boom. Certainly economic success. And so that forces us to rethink the modern history and to look for actually secrets to that success in the succession of failures.
Now, Orville, most of the blame has been put on predatory great powers. And the Opium Wars is seen often as the beginning of the decline. But haven't some of China's greatest traumas been self-inflicted, like the Taiping Rebellion of 1845 to 64? 20 million people were left dead.
Well, I think, one of the great complexities of Chinese history and culture is that, when you've fallen so far from the dynastic period of greatness to become the sick man of Asia at the turn of the last century, you, of course, need to have some explanation for it. And it's always easier to blame exogenous forces than internal forces.
But that rebellion and the length of it would suggest that there were all sorts of endemic problems in China that had nothing to do with whether Westerners came in and imposed their will.
Well, it's both, right? And the Chinese have a phrase which we talk about in the book, which is chaos and disorder from within, aggression from without. And that, particularly when you get to the Second Opium War in 1860, and we talk about that in one chapter of the book, is kind of structured around the Second Opium War. That's when, as you point out, the Taiping Civil War is raging, but at the same time you have the British and French forces. So the Chinese are aware of this. This is the dilemma they got themselves into, both domestically and internationally. Everything was leading further toward their decline.
You call some of the predictions of the 11-plus people you profile in this book prophetic. Did they also help affect the outcome rather than just predict it?
Well, of course, nobody during history's process sort of knew where it was all going. And what was so interesting for us was, from the point of the present, to look back and say, well, how did this add up? How did China finally catalyze itself to become somebody who's now having president, is having meetings with our president as if they're the E2 of the a G2 of the world? And I think what's sort of so interesting for us is about how this incredibly large and significant country with whom we are going to have to work out a lot of problems sort of thinks of itself and remembers its past. And they do it very much through the lens, I think, as you suggested a moment ago, of having been victimized.
Well, what's the significance of your title, Wealth and Power? I guess that's a translation of a Chinese term. Forgive me if I mispronounce it. Fuchang.
Mm-hmm. Well, what this represents, I think, for Chinese is a kind of a two-character phrase that suggests a certain kind of greatness from which China fell. And this is a couplet of characters that goes way back into Chinese history as kind of the basis for the for having a strong state and a wealthy populace, and was the thing that they wished to kind of regain.
Well, you write that for many prominent Chinese thinkers, wealth and power was something that their ancestors had taken for granted, and their goal was to restore it.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's why, you know, a related theme is restoration and revival, rejuvenation. So in Chinese, fuxing, and this is another term that's actually, you know, kind of littered through the period we look at, but coming back with a vengeance now. I mean, the new president, Xi Jinping, when he was installed first as general secretary of the Communist Party and then as president, on both occasions, he stressed this notion of revival. And so our book really helps explain to non-Chinese audience what they're trying to revive, you know, what that restoration is about.
But hasn't wealth and power meant different things at different times?
It has. And I think what it has meant lately is that China would be once again not only respected, but not preyed upon. You know, not a victim of the great powers of all the kinds of predations that it suffered, including Japanese occupation. So it really meant sort of regaining its ability to stand up in the world and defend itself.
Although one thing that they do agree on is that wealth and power is wealth and power for the nation of China. Where I think we see the biggest differences is in the formula to get there. And so that's where in each chapter of the book with a different person, you see often radical divergences, you know, and there's an almost increasingly desperate search for a formula that will work.
But isn't part of the tension we're seeing in China today a sense from the large part of the populace that wealth and power are really in the hands of just a small group and that everybody else has little access to it?
I think if you look on the individual level, of course, there's huge sort of a huge abyss between the newly wealthy and the people who continue to be poor in China, and this is a real issue. But I think
and when people complain, they often wind up being punished.
Well, and this is where, of course, the Chinese Revolution began, this great disparity between rich and poor, and Mao's whole idea of class warfare was calculated to sort of triumph the underclass over the overclass.
But for now, you still have a huge, what we could call middle class, and I think you know, these dynamics could change if the economy slows down. But for now, still, you have hundreds of millions of people in the middle of what you're describing for whom life is getting better year by year and for whom they expect their children to do better than they are. So I think that helps explain the stability in a system, despite what you're talking about, Leonard, of this huge gap between rich and poor.
My guests are John Deluria and Orville Schell, who have co-authored a book called Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. It's published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Now, John, you're teaching East Asian studies in Seoul, Korea.
That's right, Yonsei
University.
Does
China look different from Korea than it does from the United States?
Yeah, it does. It looks a lot bigger because we're very close to it in Korea. And it also looks bigger because we're a lot smaller than the United States. So you can really feel in a place like South Korea, you know, how the growth of China is this colossal force, you know, the shadow that it casts, both for good and ill. I think Koreans are even more sensitive to it.
But I was also wondering, because Koreans share certain philosophical history, although and that whether they would understand the role Confucianism, for example, has played in Chinese history throughout this 150 years in different ways.
No, absolutely. I mean, there was recently a very high-level summit where the new South Korean president visited Beijing, and it was quite interesting. First of all, she spoke in Chinese, which no Korean leader has done. This is the leader of South Korea. She spoke a bit in Chinese, which the Chinese loved. But she also talked about, during a difficult period in her life, how she read the Chinese classics and how she drew consolation from that. So you can see, and of course that resonated with Chinese as well, so you can see that Confucian, some scholars call it a cynic civilization, and how that will come up even in contemporary relations.
The term wealth and power was coined by Wei Yuan, who was a Confucian scholar, wasn't he?
Well, I mean, China was the epicenter of Confucianism and spread out to Japan and to Korea. So now, whereas once these were sort of tribute states, in effect, now that China has risen again, it has to kind of reestablish a new relationship with everybody around it. And this, of course, has become quite a troubled prospect because of all of the disputes that China has that have engendered around the islands that have involved almost everybody, with the exception of the Koreans, and means that China's new wealth and power has sort of caused a realignment in all of Asia and made all of these smaller countries want to more willingly run into the arms of the Americans as a kind of a safeguard against this new resurgent power, which in certain ways looks the way it did back in the Qing Dynasty when China was last ascendant.
In some cases, I've looked at the maps. Some of those islands might be reasonably claimed by China, but others not so. The Philippines, Japan, et cetera, look a lot closer. Why does China feel comfortable just claiming them all? Because it is so powerful right now?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, partially, I think the reason is because they can, and because they're very concerned about natural resources, and there's some prospect of oil and gas in the South China Sea. But there's a rather unseemly bulge that drops down like a giant udder off of China into the South China Sea, which China claims. And they've got the Philippines, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, all rather agitated at the prospect of suddenly this sort of irredentism.
Well, and add to that the international legal regime is not clear, you know, and even countries like the United States have not ratified the UN Law of the Seas. So there's no clear legal guidelines on who belongs to what. So as Orville's saying, it's a bit of a free-for-all where everyone's claiming and counter-claiming as they can.
I want to go back to an earlier part of the book. I mentioned Wei Yuan, who coined the term wealth and power. In the 1820s, he was commissioned to compose an anthology mostly of Confucian texts. But you write that when considered altogether, he preached a rival legalist doctrine, and Mao later was influenced by the legalist thought. So how important is all of this?
Yeah, well, we should clarify. I mean, we say Wei Yuan, he coined the term, but he really revived the term. This Fuqiang, this wealth and power idea goes back 2,500 years. And actually, it goes back to legalist texts. Now, who are the legalists? The legalists were almost, you know, precursors to state-led authoritarian theorists of today. They were sort of realpolitik thinkers about international relations, and they're the ones who emphasized and sort of drilled into any ruler who would listen, wealth and power, wealth and power, wealth and power. The Confucians, by contrast, were sort of like today's liberals. You know, they argued for universality of their values and this sort of thing. So this was an ancient debate between Confucians and legalists in the Chinese tradition of this kind of very hard-edged wealth and power school versus a more sort of value-based Confucian school. And we trace how that reemerged into the 19th century, and you can even see it playing out today.
Had China been in good shape before the Opium Wars?
Well, it had certain signs of internal decline, as you intimated a little bit earlier. But, you know, when the West arrived...
It was a Manchu dynasty.
Foreign dynasty for the Manchurians who'd come down from the...
So it was already a foreign imposition on China.
And much of the energy, the anti-dynastic energy of people like Sun Yat-sen, who we write about, was very much, let's kick these foreigners out and get Chinese back in power. And they did. But the result was not the halcyon republic that they had hoped for. It was chaos, feudalism, warlords, and a big mess. So this was the beginning of a very disappointing first half of the 20th century when China began sort of reaching out and trying on one ism after another. You had constitutionalism, that failed. Then there was anarchism, a little Christianity, Marxism came in. So there was an effort to sort of see what could restore China to greatness.
The treaty after the First Opium War allowed the British to colonize Hong Kong, Shanghai, some other coastal trade cities. Did the British presence have an impact on Chinese thinking?
Yeah, well, it had a profound influence. I mean, if you look at a place like Shanghai, actually.
That's the Treaty of Nanjing.
The Treaty of Nanjing. And so, that's important for our book. We sort of open with a scene where actually Orville and I visited the place where the treaty was negotiated. And there's a wonderful tiny museum there that we write about where you can see sort of a microcosm of China's understanding of its modern history. But, as you say, that set up British and other foreign countries. Their presence grew, especially in Shanghai. But then, you see a half generation later, another thinker that we profile, Feng Guifun, who's a really extraordinarily interesting and pretty original Chinese thinker. He writes a sort of reformist treatise in the 1860s, and he writes it in Shanghai. And we discuss how he's actually watching the British and French up close. He's watching them fight against the Taiping, and he's basically trying to shake his countrymen into awareness of saying, we have to learn from these guys. And so he uses this term as well. He says we have to master their techniques of wealth and power. If we combine it with our own values, our Chinese Confucian values, then we'll have arrived at the ultimate sort of civilization and ultimate great power. So that formula that he called self-strengthening in the 1860s has a pretty deep resonance today in what China is trying to do.
And was, in a way, Deng Xiaoping's formula.
That's right.
My guests are Orville Schell and John Delury. Their book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, published by Random House. We'll continue our conversation after this. Normally, I try to give you a sense of all of the accomplishments of my guests, but these guests have just too many. I want to devote more time to our conversation, so just trust me, Orville Schell and John Delury, if you want to talk about China, they are the ones you want to talk with. Their latest book, this is the first time you've collaborated, right, is Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century. It is published by Random House. The man we were talking about earlier, Wei Yuan, thought that China should let itself feel humiliated. Why? He wrote the first history of the Opium Wars, didn't he?
So this is a very sort of counterintuitive proposition. How can a country that has sort of elaborated a whole narrative about victimization and humiliation, how can they sort of overcome the obvious sort of passivity that such a and the indignity that such a circumstance sort of imposes on them?
Doesn't Confucianism to some degree encourage that
so
passivity?
So this is the great paradox, that in a certain sense Confucianism does emphasize modesty and self-reflection, and that even has a notion that humiliation and can lead to a kind of a curious energy. Instead of just lying supine, this sort of victimization was in a certain sense calculated to stimulate China into action to restore itself.
And you say China still has a bit of a humiliation complex in that their accomplishments don't stack up to their perceived confidence level.
Well, I think you can say that despite their immense accomplishments in the last 20 years or so, their sort of belief in themselves and their ability to transcend their humiliation and victim culture still lags behind. And this may take a couple of generations. So the question is, what do you do when you had 100 years of looking at yourself as a victim? Marxism has spun a whole web around that of being preyed upon by imperialist outside powers. How do you get over that when you succeed?
Well, and we should add in, you know, we're focusing on Britain and the West and the United States, but obviously a big chunk of this modern history, the defining power for China is Japan.
And in fact, this year's National Humiliation Day focused on Japan because there's still a lot of tension.
That's right. And every year, September 18th is the anniversary of when in 1931 World War II began for China, with Japan's invasion of Manchuria. And I was there, happened to be there last year, as crowds gathered outside of the Japanese embassy. And, you know, just taking a taxi cab through the city of Beijing, all it took was one question to my driver, and he just went off on how, well, I'm not picking up any Japanese people today. Literally. And this was out without being provoked, you know. So there's a whole interesting debate about to what extent the Communist Party and other rulers in China have manipulated this sentiment. And they do. At the same time, all they have to do is flip a switch and it's there. So when we sort of – part of our argument is to challenge Chinese to say you need to transcend this humiliation complex. And I'm already hearing this from my friends in China. They say, hey, wait a second. We're not ready for that. And Japan hasn't done the work it needs to do before we're ready for that.
Well, Japan, by still engaging in a certain amount of denial, is only exacerbating the situation, I'd imagine, in the eyes of the Chinese. But I'm curious about this National Humiliation Day. It was established in 1927 by Chiang Kai-shek. How did the communists tend to pick up the idea?
Well, for the communists, this is where sort of Leninism dovetailed, because Leninism had this notion that imperialism was the way in which capitalist countries prolong their ability to survive by going out and exploiting poor backward countries. So this idea fit in quite nicely with China's propensity to see itself as a victim. I think what's sort of curious is while they really don't have a tremendous amount of love for Japan, when it comes to America, even though we are part of the West and thus part of the sort of predatory great power network, there is a very much more deeply ambivalent love-hate relationship with the United States and much admiration and much, I think, seduction.
Well, why did they ignore the Japanese model during the Meiji period, where Japan modernized very quickly? China seemed to almost make it illegal to think in terms of the West.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'd agree they ignored it. I mean, one thing we talk about, it's quite interesting. In some ways, the Chinese came up with this model. The Japanese read these thinkers in China, but they read them more carefully. And then through a confluence of things where the Japanese political system was moving toward greater centralization, under the leadership of the Meiji elite, they actually did this. You know, they implemented this self-strengthening formula, whereas, as you say, the Qing was heading in the opposite direction. The Qing was already falling apart. Military and political power was devolving to provinces. And so – and you know, we have a whole chapter on the Empress Dowager Cixi. In a strange way, she did her best. But ultimately, she was a cipher. I mean, she was a weak leader at the top at a time when China needed a very strong paramount leader who would drive these reforms through. So the result is Japan gets way out ahead of China, and China can never catch up until literally the last couple decades.
Although she had a nickname, the Dragon Lady, you say that her female gender was a highly un-Confucian impropriety.
Well, Confucianism sort of reveres the male sort of in the family, and the whole family lineage goes down through the male line. So women are definitely, in Confucian view of things, subsidiary. And here was one ruling China for almost 50 years.
Well, she became empress twice, didn't she?
Yes, she did. And she had to, when she met her grand council, she had to do it behind a screen. She couldn't even come out and sort of meet with the guys because she wasn't a guy. So this was sort of an anomaly in its own right. And then you have to imagine. So here's Japan as the Meiji Restoration not only succeeds in modernizing Japan, which is considered to be the younger brother, a lesser culture, a lesser place, then they come and they beat the Chinese in a war and sink the Chinese Navy in 1895. This was a deep and profound humiliation. They weren't just beat by Westerners with better cannons. They were beat by an Asian power who was supposed to be an inferior.
So what did Chinese thinkers and leaders learn from those defeats?
Well, a lot of them learned, there was one expression that, you know, you have to learn the shame of not being Japanese. Not that they wanted to be Japanese, but they felt the shame of being Chinese.
Another thing that this defeat in the Sino-Japanese War of 1895 triggered was a very important sort of new tendency, which was to identify the problem that these Chinese reformers faced as lying much deeper than military reforms. Because they had actually done some military so-called self-strengthening. They were still routed by the Japanese. So they said military spending is not enough. Some even argued, you know, political reforms are actually not going to fix our problems. What we need is to somehow change Chinese consciousness. And we use this figure of Liang Qichao, who's a quite brilliant and fascinating turn-of-the-century public intellectual. He really erupts with this idea about changing consciousness. And in some ways, in some strange and tragic ways, Mao Zedong, you know, brings that project to culmination.
You also cite another political thinker, Feng Guifen, who admired how the Japanese had adapted to Western influence and wrote, "We Chinese will be meat and fish for the 100 other nations of the world if we don't adopt similar strategies."
Yeah.
Were people listening?
No. And in the case of Feng Guifen, he didn't even dare have his treatise published because he thought it was too dangerous. Now, it still circulated a lot. But the first publication and where it really was well known was not until almost 30 years after. And at that point, the emperor, the standing emperor of China, actually said, "Everyone needs to read Feng Guifen." And he ordered his top 1,000 officials, "I want you to read it, comment on what we should actually do, and then I'll try and implement it." But that was already 30, 40 years too late. So you can see the problem they got themselves into.
Didn't China go through a brief golden age in the 1930s? What was going on that helped boost national morale and led to this great explosion in the arts?
So Chiang Kai-shek came to power. He launched an expedition. He unified the country in the late 20s and moved his capital to Nanjing. And this was a period where people were very hopeful. For the first time, there was a national government. It had a leader. And China seemed to be getting itself together after a period of tremendous disunity. And then the Japanese came. And so it's a really big question mark in history of what would have happened. Would have Chiang Kai-shek have been able to persevere if Japanese hadn't occupied and thrown the whole thing out of kilter? Would the communists then have been quietly erased by very strong nationalist campaigns against his diminished guerrilla bands in the hills? It's hard to say.
Well, so Mao comes to power. And depending on how you look at it, he is an incredibly destructive force with the Great Leap Forward and then the Cultural Revolution, or he is a man who changes the Chinese sensibility and leads to the current situation. We did have one of the Lin Yutang? Mm-hmm. Somebody came on the show and cited the old cliche about, well, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. Well, there were millions and millions of people who died. That's a lot of eggs that were broken.
Mao was definitely a paradox. He was savage and brutal, and his revolution was tectonic in its impact on China. But he did succeed in doing one thing that no one else could succeed in doing before him, which was to break China loose from its old traditional Confucian culture that many, many reformers saw as stultifying, suffocating. And that, in a certain sense, you can say, kind of cleared the field for Deng Xiaoping to come along and not have to worry about fighting the past and that deep-seated traditional conservatism that had gripped the country.
Shortly after Xi Jinping took office last year, he declared, "The Chinese people have finally taken hold of their destiny." So is the victimization finally been put to rest?
Well, not yet. You know, and Xi Jinping, we're watching with great interest. I mean, in part because he's helping do some of the marketing for our book, because it's as if he's speaking out of the script that we've written. He's emphasized the wealth and power notion as well. But I don't know what you think, Orville. I mean, I do see signs that Xi Jinping wants over, he probably has 10 years in power, that he does want to move toward a greater confidence for China on the world stage. You know, Mao famously declared that in 1949, when he took power, he said, "We've taken our stand." You know, and Xi Jinping is now trying to sort of move beyond taking our stand, which is a sort of defensive. You can't bully us anymore. I think Xi Jinping does want to lead China to a different kind of standing in the world, but you know, his people are not necessarily ready, and the world is not necessarily yet ready to welcome China, because the world doesn't know what China stands for, what values it's going to contribute.
Well, you give credit to the Chinese Communist Party and China's authoritarian past for the economic growth and political stability it's been able to create. But if I were a young factory worker working God knows how many hours and living in terrible dormitories, would I consider that a fair trade-off?
Well, I think up until now, many Chinese have. They've thought, okay, we can get rich, we can have a better life, there's a certain stability, we will trade sort of political rights for this great privilege, which China has never had before. But the real question is that going forward, once China as a nation gains wealth and power, and once more and more people gain access to the middle class, then they do begin to ask this sort of meaning of life question, but what's it all about?
But we've been hearing this for 20 years or so, that China's future is obviously more democratic, and it hasn't worked out that way.
Well, that's precisely one of the reasons we wrote this book, was to try to ascertain whether political reform necessarily means that you have to open up politically. To date, the answer is a resounding no.
So the economic reform hasn't led to more democracy?
No. It's led to much more openness in life, but not to change in the political system.
My thanks to both of you so much for being on our show. Orville Schell, John Delury. Their book, Wealth and Power, China's Long March to the 21st Century, is published by Random House.